I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Jens Lindemann joins me now. The world-renowned trumpet virtuoso is part of the K. Meek Art Center 20th Anniversary Gala this Saturday, the 23rd of November. As the cornerstone for arts and community events in West Vancouver celebrates bringing world-class arts as it has, it'll do the same this Saturday with a dinner and concert. There are two events, a concert at 8 p.m. headlined by the Trans-Canada Highwaymen, hosted by Lisa Christensen and Grant Lawrence. But earlier in the evening, Jens Lindemann and a pianist, also a K. Meek Arts Center advisor, Ian Parker, will entertain guests at an elegant dinner. Visit kmeek.com for tickets and information. I talked to Jens last week about his storied career as a musician, how he approaches performing, as well as a new album, Live at Larry's. It's a terrific album of jazz and pop standards featuring Jens and his trumpet and flugelhorn, as well as Robbie Botos, Mike Downs, and Christian Alexandrov. It's available everywhere you get your tunes, like Apple Music. Jens Lindemann has played jazz and classical in every major concert venue in the world, not to mention sporting events like the 2010 Olympics, the Rose Bowl, as well as Madison Square Garden for a Rangers game, among many others. He's recorded with the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, as well as performed at a solo command performance for Queen Elizabeth II. He played lead trumpet with the Canadian Brass, as well as won accolades like the Grammy, Juno nominations, the Echo Classic, and International Brass Personality of the Year from Brass Herald. He's received several honorary doctorates and is a member of the Order of Canada. Visit trumpetsolo.com for more information. He joined me while on vacation in Maui last week. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Jens Lindemann. Mr. Lindemann, good morning.
A real pleasure to be here. Great to chat with you.
Nice to talk to you. Where have I reached you today, Jens?
Oh, you're going to hate me and your listeners will hate me, but I'm standing on a beach in Maui right now. Don't hate too much. I just wanted a break before coming to Vancouver next week. Well, I'm very much looking forward to returning stateside.
Well, what a shame for you. we were just chatting before we started. On the weekend, I was on my Apple Music on my phone, and I put the things in my ears, and I started listening to Live at Larry's. And it's a great album. There's so many great cuts on there, great charts. And then I was wondering as I was listening to it, where Larry's was.
First of all, it's a great question, and thank you for listening to it. I literally just posted it a week ago. Mm. Anybody listening to this podcast are the first people to even hear about the recording. The long and short of it is Larry's is a house. It's Larry's house in Calgary. He's a very dear friend and a friend to the arts in particular, and he wanted to, he wanted to support a recording with a bunch of really prominent Canadian jazz musicians. And initially he had suggested we do it in a studio in Calgary. And I said, Larry, why don't we just do it in your house? He has a beautiful piano which overlooks the Elbow River. And when he was building his home, he literally said, you know, I'm building it with this in mind, to have music and friends over doing chamber music in this very space. And I said, this is where we should do it. So we did. And in the spirit of Miles Davis and the iconic recording Kind of Blue, mm-hmm. We didn't rehearse anything. We literally showed up at Larry's. I had a 16-time Grammy-winning engineer set up the microphones in just a way to capture all the greatest acoustical attributes of the home. And we would live at the house, which is why it's Live at Larry's, but also Live at Larry's, and do full takes of, It was a great bit of fun. And the idea, of course, was to capture that spontaneity. So I'm so glad that you discovered it. I haven't, as I said, even really announced it yet to the world, but I will now.
The Shadow of Your Smile is a song that my parents listened to that. And as a kid, I never really liked it. And then on that album, I've gained such a new appreciation for it because of the way that you all play it. You're terrific on George on My Mind, which is a song that everyone knows. But there's a certain freshness to it, with your horn. And the other one that I love is that Bay Min Bistishen.
By Mia Bistishen. Yeah,
what sure. I've heard that song over the years, and, I thought of it, just a folk song. But it's such fun to hear that on the album.
I try to remind people now that the word pop music means popular.
Mm.
So if it was ever popular at any phase in musical history, then it was a great song. There were a lot of really bad songs written at those times, and there were really good songs that captured the imagination of the listener. And those are the kinds of songs that truly are timeless. So I'm with you. When I was younger, I didn't quite understand it. And now the simplicity and the depth of some of those songs and bringing them back to life, I think that is the entire ethos of what, you know, the arts are about,
yeah.
Trying to transmit something that's not really quantifiable to the listener, and we should be doing it with all music, and good music in particular. So it's, I think it's important to mine history and find those works that really captured people's, curiosity and keep them alive and fresh.
And you all seem to have such fun playing these songs. I mean, that's what I'm hearing as I'm listening to the album.
Well, again, that's why I mentioned Miles Davis and the iconic Kind of Blue recording. Kind of Blue is literally considered one of the greatest jazz recordings, if not the greatest jazz recording in history. It started the birth of cool, is what we call it in terms of jazz history.
Mm-hmm.
But what makes it really unique is that none of the musicians had the music until they showed up at the session. And even in that case, Miles did one or two takes, and that was it. And he wanted to capture, again, what I call the spontaneous conversation of musicians listening and reacting to each other without rehearsing. When you rehearse, you capture certain things, but you also lose what you had the very first time.
Mm.
And the idea behind the Live at Larry's recording, which, of course, is also a double entendre because we lived at Larry's, was to capture music that way, the way you would literally in a home somewhere, at a campfire, or just the spontaneous music making that really captures people. So we tried to do that, and that was definitely part of the fun behind it.
It's come through a great deal. It's such an enjoyable album. Congratulations on it, and I hope a lot of people pick it up and listen to it.
Thank you very much.
Have you played the K Meek Center before?
I have, and I love playing at the K Meek Center. It's one of those little jewels that, if you didn't know it was there, you would drive right past it.
Mm.
And if you've been there, you understand what I mean. And then when you get inside it, you realize here's a world-class recital, level hall, meaning I think, what was the seating there, 400 or 500 perhaps? I'm not sure of the exact seating number, but it's exquisite size for both chamber music and anything slightly larger than chamber music. A really wonderful place to play.
And so we're talking here about 10 days or so before the gala. Have you worked out with Ian Parker what your program will be?
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
we are adopting the same attitude as the Live at Larry's recording, where we've talked about it over the phone, and we will literally rehearse it the morning of. And I'll tell you something, that is exactly as we would have liked to do it, because the point of a gala is to have it be the point of any music making, but in particular at a gala, you want it to be a celebration of being together. And I think there's nothing more virtuous with artists than if they're not afraid to expose themselves musically, emotionally, spiritually, if you will, to the listener. To say, we don't know exactly how this is going to go, but we want you to enjoy the process of us trying to find our way through it as well. So there's something very magical about that. So Ian and I will probably still be making changes 6 hours before we actually meet.
That's a marvelous way to think about art and music especially, but just life in general, isn't it?
I agree. And you can only do that musically if you're working with people that you totally trust.
Mm.
And there's a complete trust between Ian, for Ian and myself, for each other, rather. We have a lot of respect and an ability to sort of say, let's do this. We're not afraid to do it. In fact, we rather would prefer to do it this way. And again, that is something that that you can only capture live. Recordings are awesome, and many recordings, for instance, that are done in studio sessions are really rehearsed with an inch of their life. And again, as I said, there are certain things that come out in the music when it's that perfectly balanced and nuanced. But there are things that you also just lose out on in terms of the spontaneous factor, I would say.
So when you're playing the trumpet and you're playing a particular song that you know that the audience knows, what are you hearing in the moment? Are you hearing what you're playing, or are you thinking about what the next notes will be, say?
That's an excellent question, and it's taken me a lifetime to try to figure it out, and I'm getting better and better at it, but it's actually the first part of your answer. The beauty of any form of art, when it really gets elevated to another level, is that you yourself as the performer are lost in the moment. You are so lost in the moment that you're really not, you're aware but unaware of what you're actually doing. And when you truly get to that state, the audience feels that. It's a very hard thing to describe, but it's like watching a golfer get into the zone on a PGA weekend. Golf is a solitary sport. It is an art form. You're not competing against anybody except your own mind. And then you get people that are so zoned in and dialed into what they're doing that day that they're unaware of how great the moment it is. You know, if it was easy to do, anybody would do it.
Yeah.
And that's, of course, why it's rare. Music in the arts has the exact same impact on a listener, I think.
Yeah, that's the other thing. I've been watching videos of you as of late, and you make it easy. But, I mean, obviously, that's the years of preparation. That's the rehearsals. That's the warm-ups every day and the sort, right?
You are correct. I've also been a professor at UCLA for 24 years now. And one of the very first things, one of the very first things I learned when I was a student, just starting my undergrad, it was something my teacher said to me on the first day. I never forgot it, and I tell it to every new student I ever meet, whether it's private or in a master class. And he looked at me and literally said, "I am not here to teach you. I'm here to teach you to teach yourself."
Mm.
And even a young aspiring artist understands intrinsically what that means. It means it's an inward journey, and you are responsible for doing the things in such a repetitive manner that it sounds and becomes ultimately second nature. The other thing I'm very fond of saying is that you can't have experience until you've actually experienced something, which is both a positive and a negative. But, you know, you understand exactly what I mean by that. The repetition is what provides the type of experience that allows you to do things where you appear to be on autopilot. But there are a lot of steps that led up to that.
Do you rehearse every day? Do you warm up every day?
If students are listening, the answer is yes, absolutely, of course I do. And for students who've now turned away, I do what I call focused work, or you know, the kind of work that basically, because of my career, because I do many styles of music from, you know, Baroque and classical to jazz and pop, and even a foray into country music. That's coming next year. We'll get into that in another conversation. It's very focused work on what type of music I'm preparing for at that time. And the truth is, when I was young, yes, there were a lot of particular etudes and exercises that I did on a daily basis. But the reality is you get to a certain point where that becomes less important. Let me rephrase that and carefully. It's not that it's less important. It's that as we get older, you realize you have less time.
Mm-hmm.
Again, this is something that young people don't understand. They think 60 seconds is a minute forever, but it's not. And when you have less time as an adult, you become far more focused on solving the exact problems that you have to figure out for a particular piece or performance, rather than worrying about the two-hour routine that you do on a daily basis, followed by cappuccino and a meditation set, or whatever it is that you can do when you have young and, you know, that amount of time.
And in terms of listening to music, how much of that do you do a day?
You know, that's also an interesting question. Not as much anymore as I used to, and it's a really good question. You know, it doesn't seem to make any sense that a professional musician wouldn't be listening to music all the time, except that, again, you take advantage of what time you do have, so that when I do listen, I listen with a type of intensity to whatever it is I'm focusing on that I didn't when I was younger. You're around music at all times, and we all should be around music at all times. But as a professional, you listen with a type of intent. And then even then, once in a while, you still just get blown away by something. For instance, I very openly say, I think everybody in the world should have one tune that they listen to that just makes them cry. They don't know why, but you put it on and you can get some tears out, and it's a good way to cleanse the soul. And for me, that's the last 20 minutes of Mahler's Second Symphony. Right when the choir comes in, the last 18 minutes or so, by the end of it, I'm bawling like a baby and I always feel better afterward.
That's another great piece of advice. In terms of, so do I take it that listening for pleasure, for example, I already have a sense of what your answer is, but I mean, you don't really just pick up your phone and start listening to something for fun, do you?
No, rarely.
Just,
again, it's because you know too much, and so you listen, again, with targeted ears. But again, the wonderment of the arts is that even when you're listening with too much information, you still make little discoveries that throw you for a loop. And that's why it's important to remember to your earlier point about talking about a recording like Live at Larry's, which was all based on the idea we're going to take these 4 or 5 minute songs from the past, we're going to play them spontaneously, we're going to play them beautifully, and just let the music speak. And that often resonates with people who are not necessarily professionals, but it touches them in a way that professionals need to take and pay attention to that, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Sometimes, as a professional, you can get so caught up in what you're doing that you forget that the ultimate goal is to share that with the listener. And if you're not putting the listener in a good mood or have given them some kind of an emotional state after you've played, you have missed the point of performing.
There's a terrific video of you on your YouTube channel, and it's you and Arturo Sandoval sitting on a sofa just chatting. At one point, he goes and grabs a trumpet and starts playing. And the first time I saw that, you know, I'm watching him. And then the second time I saw that, I'm watching you, because here you are sitting next to a peer. And I was curious, what are you watching at that point? Are you watching his hands? Are you looking at his fingering? Are you looking at his chops, his mouth, say, his posture even? I mean, are you listening to the music itself?
It's, again, a very, very good question. Well, first of all, I'm sitting beside a legend, somebody who was very inspirational to me growing up. Then, secondly, I'm sitting there as a friend.
Yeah.
Technically, I'm interviewing him. So we're there as a couple of trumpet colleagues and buddies, and I think the joy and the curiosity you see on my face is an exact description of how wonderful it is to sit beside someone who is not just only a master of their instrument, but speaks with the type of musical and spiritual spontaneous freedom that, as the great Tommy Banks once said to me, you want to actually just be in the shadow of that kind of a genius and let some of it rub off on you if you can. So just being around it is the very thing that made it such an enjoyable activity for me, and I'm glad you noticed that.
Yeah. So sitting next to him, and I'm sure you've done this many times before, you obviously learn a lot from him every single time, don't you?
Oh, without a doubt. You can learn something from people, if you're paying attention, you can learn something from people you've been around your entire life. For 6 years, for example, 6 years I toured with the Canadian Brass.
Mm-hmm.
We were together for 200 shows a year, and you're on top of each other, you're with each other. Every little nuance is noticed in a concert. If somebody moves a 16th note, a 32nd of a beat, one way or the other, you're sensitive to it in a way that the listener never could be. So, in a way, you're kind of on autopilot because you know each other so well. And yet, when you reflect on the importance of that kind of nuanced discovery of people you think you know really well, it's in later months and years, in this case, where you go back and say, you know, I totally missed how awesome it was to be able to do this with you, and now I understand it. Again, coming to your very first words on this interview about rediscovering music that was always great, but for whatever reason in our lives, we didn't pay attention to it, and then you come back to it because it is great, and now we are paying attention in a way that we understand and appreciate.
And in that video, he's smoking a cigar. And then I was wondering about that in terms of is that advisable for trumpet players, sir?
Well, clearly the answer is no. And right at the beginning of that video, even Arturo says, you know, I've been smoking since I was 12, you know, so don't do this. But he's done it since he was a kid. It's a very Cuban thing. And no, certainly nothing I would recommend. But Arturo gets to do whatever he wants. At this point in his life, he doesn't answer to anyone, and he just is who he is.
So how do you maintain your self in terms of your when you play? I mean, do you have to fuss about things like your diet and things that sort?
No. Again, coming back to my career with the Canadian Brass, that's when all of that went away. I mean, imagine you're doing 200 shows a year with a brass quintet. These are two and a half hour concerts in a different hall every single night. So there's no consistency. It's not like an orchestra player where you have a particular chair and that's mm-hmm. exactly where the chair is positioned every night and you know who's around you. That's a whole different art form. And when you get into a chamber situation like that with five soloists who have to pull off a two-hour show for 2,000 or 3,000 people in a hall, you learn very quickly that it comes back to your earlier question about routine. Routine in and of itself kind of goes out the window, and autopilot has to kick in, and that only kicks in if you have done the routine at some point. So it's after the Canadian Brass, I very quickly learned there's no need. In fact, I'll say this very honestly, I have never been nervous to play a concert since being with the Canadian Brass.
Really?
That doesn't mean I was always ready for a concert.
Yeah,
it didn't
yeah.
matter that I matter. Pardon me, mean that I always played a great concert. But nerves, in the sense that we have nerves when we're younger and less experienced, they're gone. I have a good time on stage. I'm as honest as I can be with the public, and nervousness just doesn't factor into it. And that's an important, enlightened stage to get to, I think, if possible.
Yeah. There's another video of yours that I've seen years ago, and I guess I didn't realize until recently that it was you, where you're playing O Canada in the middle of a snowstorm in Alberta. In terms of the cold weather, because I kept wondering that as I was watching the video again, how does the cold weather react to your lungs as you're playing like that?
Well, to lungs and lips, cold weather is sort of, you know, not the greatest of things, and O Canada is only about 75 seconds long, so I managed. But that it's funny that you mentioned that video. It went viral because we were stranded. It was actually kind of a dangerous situation. There was well over 1,000 cars stranded between Canmore and about a 10-mile stretch beyond that, heading eastward, that could not go anywhere for the better part of 12 hours. And, you know, people were starting to run out of fuel and their gas to keep the cars warm. And so I grabbed the trumpet very spontaneously just to kind of entertain people. And a 17-year-old girl was in a car behind me and said, "Hey, do you mind if I film this?" And I said, "Sure." And she sent it to a friend who had a little tiny local radio station somewhere south of Calgary. It quickly, because it was on the news, it blew up to all the national networks.
Yeah.
Even Glenn Sather called me from New York City and said, "Hey, what are you doing out there saving people in the snow?" So it was a very, very strange experience. So I have been labeled Snowstorm Trumpeter ever since then. That is my viral moment.
And it's a great moment because everybody who's, you know, all the truckers and the people, they're honking their horns after, and you're playing off of them after the national anthem. It's just a great moment. I was in reading about you. I noticed that you worked with Doc Severinsen once. Is that right?
Oh, many times. He's become one of my closest friends, and yes, he is without a doubt my first hero of the trumpet, and still continues to be.
Yeah, he just turned 97. I was looking that up. So he's known, you know, for the Tonight Show and the funny clothes he wore. But as a musician, what was he like? I mean, he was a good trumpeter, wasn't he?
He was a spectacular trumpeter. What made Doc so incredibly successful, two things. One is that he essentially made his career on live television. There were no do-overs. There was the kind of exact spontaneity and honesty and trust that you had to have in front of camera and with your musicians and for the audience that allowed you to just not think but rather be. That was number one. Number two, really, really critical not only to have your fundamentals together, but understand that everything you do is for the audience. He told me famously once, I said, I'm getting ready to do a new show, Doc. It's called Brass Fire. And he says, "Well, that sounds pretty good, Jens." That's what he called me, and still calls me. He says, "You're going to need about 11 tunes. You better be damn sure they're humming 9 of them on the way out the door." And I always chuckled. And then one day you wake up and realize how profound the statement is. Because what he was really saying was, and you weren't listening at first, 2 tunes, you get to do anything you want, anything that's important to you, you can do twice. Once is maybe not enough, twice is perfect, and 3 times is greedy. The other time is for the audience. So again, his genius is overlooked by his flamboyance just on stage sometimes and the way that he is, but he was like another great star of that era who I've recently been reading about, and that was the great Victor Borge, who I saw when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And later in life, when you watch documentaries on Victor Borge, you see the genius of what he's doing and his ability to really be a spectacular artist while making the audience smile at the same time.
Yeah, Severinsen was often very funny on the show with Johnny. And you mentioned Victor Borge, another great humorist. That marvelous ability for comic timing probably came from being a musician for both of them, right?
I think so, because one of the tenets, again, I try to remind younger musicians of, especially brass players and trumpeters in particular, have a sense of humor about yourself and what you're doing. Because when you clam a note on a trumpet, everybody will know. There is no hiding it between the 10 fingers that are at the keyboard. You are the soprano of the brass area, and when something goes wrong, it's pretty evident. And one of the best ways to deal with that kind of stress is to smile and basically relax yourself in a way that says you have a sense of humor about yourself. Invariably, you will play better if you really believe and use that tenet as a driving motivator when you perform.
What is it like for you, Jens, when a young person comes up to you and says, watches you work and comes up to you afterwards and says, I want to do that when I grow up? Well, what do you tell them?
Well, first of all, it's the greatest feeling ever because I was that kid. I still am that kid. I have mentors like Doc who I still revere. And I think that what it does is it reminds you of the inherent curiosity that we all have or are capable of having. And when somebody says, I really admire that, I want to be able to do that, then you have to live up to that role in terms of not just being a mentor, but also just in terms of being an example. It has to be really appreciated that you have this opportunity to inspire people at a younger age. They don't know what they're getting into, because either did I. And then if you're blessed to have the kind of a career that I have, you should share that. You have to find a way to give back to people, not just audiences, but especially aspiring young artists.
Jens, I've so enjoyed talking to you today, and I so appreciate your time, especially since you're on holiday. Break a leg for the 23rd at the K-Meek, and safe travels. Thanks for this.
Thank you. It was wonderful chatting with you as well, and my view truly is spectacular right now, so this has not been a chore.
The website for more is at trumpetsolo.com. The K-Meek Art Center 20th Anniversary Gala is this Saturday, the 23rd of November. For tickets to both events, visit kmeek.com. Jens Lindemann joined me on the line from Maui in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.